All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's May 12th, and this is your last lecture for human physiology, Bio 241. So this is, May 12th. Good. Well, let's see. After today, you've got a final. So let's make sure we know when the final is. It's a week from today, Tuesday, at 10:30, right in this room. Okay, so 10:30 to 12:30. And the material on that test is going to be the second chapter in cardiovascular, which is cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure. And so that's 14. Chapter 16, which is respiratory system, and then chapter 17, which is urinary, which is what we're going to finish today. So I believe I've got it straight. Everybody else got it straight? This room at 10:30. Yes. I don't have the date on my little cheat sheet, but a week from today. I think the 19th sounds right. Yeah? Okay, good. Fantastic. So it's just going to be a regular test, you know, about 100 questions. You only need one Scantron. Make sure you have a good eraser with you one more time. And, you know, however long it's been taking you to complete a test is how much time you need, which is usually less than 2 hours, right? So you'll get out of here whenever you're done with the test. So it's an hour to 2 hour test, just like any of the others. It's not by design cumulative, but of course this course kind of builds on information from previous discussions. Okay, so let's see. Any questions on urinary system? I think we're about on this slide right here, resorption of salt and water. Okay. And so I'll start the program up. I think I'm going backward just a little bit. Maybe I didn't talk about that slide. All right. Well, maybe I'll talk about extrinsic control of glomerular filtration. All right. So glomerular filtration pretty much depends on the amount of blood that's entering the glomerulus. And so it's blood flow through the glomerulus, and that can be controlled by blood pressure, of course. What else? What else can control blood flow through the glomerulus? As a matter of fact, in your body, what is the most important mechanism for controlling blood flow from one part of the body to the other? Do you change the length of the blood vessel, or do you change the viscosity of the blood, or what? Okay, if you're going to hold blood pressure constant, you're going to? What does Poiseuille's equation say? And that you should know something about for Tuesday. Poiseuille's equation is the... It's a very powerful factor. It's the most important factor in Poiseuille's equation. I'm giving you a lot of really good hints. Okay? It is the radius. Yeah, because you have to multiply, what, the radius times the radius times the radius times the radius. Radius to the fourth power. That means small changes in radius means big changes in blood flow through an organ. All right? So that's real important to forget. As a matter of fact, never forget that. That's a good one to always remember. Okay, so how can you adjust blood flow through the glomerulus? The afferent arteriole has smooth muscle around it, and that smooth muscle can constrict or can dilate. All right, so that's how blood flow through the, one of the ways that blood flow through the glomerulus is controlled, by controlling the radius of that smooth muscle at the afferent arteriole. All right, so sympathetic effects of glomerular filtration. And since the sympathetic nervous system, what can you tell me about the sympathetic nervous system compared to the nephron? Is it a part of the nephron, or is it outside the nephron? Where's your sympathetic nervous system? Yeah, it's all over your body, right? Your sympathetic nervous system is, it begins in your central nervous system. How does it get out of your central nervous system? What is sympathetic outflow like? That takes you back to anatomy. That is what? It's thoracolumbar outflow, and then it goes through sympathetic chain, or maybe through a prevertebral ganglia, and then to the kidney. All right, so since it's outside the nephron, we call that extrinsic control. What does intrinsic control mean? When something is regulating and it's a mechanism completely contained within the nephron. That's intrinsic control. Extrinsic means that it's coming from outside the nephron. All right, so before I talk about that. What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation called? Structural and functional unit. We might have to go back a little bit further. What's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell. What's the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction? Sarcomere. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? A synapse. Yeah, you guys are doing really good. Now, what about for structural and functional unit of urine formation? What do we call that? That is a nephron, right? That's a nephron. Remember, a nephron's got those two parts to it. It's got tubular elements, vascular elements. And so right now, we're just talking about vascular elements and how that controls glomerular filtration. And the sympathetic nervous system is outside the nephron, right? So that's extrinsic control. All right, so if you experience a decrease in blood pressure, that could be a stimulus, or exercise produces the same thing. All right, if there's a decrease in blood pressure, what system in your body is going to measure that, be aware of that? The? Okay, blood pressure. Oh, you know, the hypothalamus will. And the hypothalamus is going to control some endocrine control. But what I'm really interested in is sympathetic, right? So I'm interested more in nervous reflexes, nerve reflexes. So what kind of nerve reflex can monitor and adjust blood pressure? It is the baroreceptor reflex, right? So when there's a decrease in blood pressure, that is monitored by the baroreceptors, and the baroreceptors, remember the receptors are in the carotid sinus, for instance, and that sends information to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla, and the medulla is the integration center. It's got a set point, and if there's a decrease in blood pressure, then the medulla is going to make a decision on what to do, right? And to increase blood pressure, it's going to increase sympathetic tone, increase sympathetic nerve activity. And what's the effect of sympathetic nerve activity on your body? Well, we could break it down into the heart and blood vessels, right? So on the heart, what's going to be the action of increased sympathetic tone on the heart? Heart rate's going to increase, right? It's a positive chronotropic effect. It's going to have a positive inotropic effect, so stroke volume is going to increase. And if heart rate and stroke volume increase, what else can you tell me? What's stroke volume times heart rate called? That's cardiac output. So cardiac output goes up because they're directly related to each other. All right, sympathetic nerve activity or increase in sympathetic tone is going to also affect the afferent arterioles at the nephron, and it's going to cause vasoconstriction. So if the afferent arteriole vasoconstricts, what happens to blood flow going through the glomerulus? It's going to decrease in a big way because of Poiseuille's equation, right? And so what happens to glomerular filtration then? It goes down because there isn't the same amount of blood going through the glomerulus, and as the filtration rate decreases, urine production decreases, and of course, when urine production decreases, then a person has a tendency to retain fluid in their body, right? You're going to get more venous return. The heart is going to fill a little bit more. And what happens to heart in terms of contractility when it fills a little bit more, when the preload of the heart goes up? Does it get stronger or weaker? Does it stay the same? It gets stronger. Yeah, what's the name of that law? That's called the Frank-Starling law of the heart. Okay, this is all from chapter 14 stuff. So then that increases blood pressure as a result of that. And how is this response compared to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it. So this maintains homeostasis by a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, the other thing is the sympathetic nerves increase vasoconstriction, general vasoconstriction in the skin and gastrointestinal tract. All right, so what happens to resistance when a blood vessel vasoconstricts? It goes way up, right, because of the fourth power rule. So that increases total peripheral resistance. All right, so then what happens to blood pressure when total peripheral resistance increases? Because what is blood pressure equal to? It's equal to stroke volume times heart rate times peripheral resistance. They're all directly related to blood pressure. And don't forget, stroke volume times heart rate is cardiac output. So blood pressure is equal to cardiac output times resistance, total peripheral resistance. We did that little derivation on the board. All right, so this is a pretty handy diagram to appreciate. Okay. So that's extrinsic regulation of glomerular filtration, but there's also a couple of intrinsic mechanisms. And so when we say intrinsic, what is that we're going to rely upon? Just something that includes the nephron only, not any nervous reflexes. You don't need a spinal cord or brain. It's just the way that the nephron is made. All right, so autoregulation, renal autoregulation is defined as the ability of the kidneys to maintain a constant filtration rate in the face of fluctuating blood pressure. So somebody's blood pressure could go up or down, but their kidneys are going to remain the same, contain the same function, a constant function. All right, so because if your blood pressure decreased without autoregulation, then glomerular filtration is going to decrease. If blood pressure goes up, then glomerular filtration will increase. And that's not how we want our bodies to operate. We want to have better control over urine formation. So there are two mechanisms responsible for that. Myogenic constriction of the afferent arteriole due just to the smooth muscle responding to an increase in arterial pressure. So just by changes in blood pressure, the afferent arteriole will automatically constrict or dilate. So if we want to maintain constant glomerular filtration and if blood pressure increases, that's going to force more blood into the glomerulus, then the afferent arteriole is going to constrict, right, to maintain blood flow constant so that urine formation is constant. All right, so that's what we call the myogenic response of the afferent arteriole. Right, there's another effect, and again, it's intrinsic, and because it's intrinsic, we call it autoregulation. All right, it's achieved via effects of locally produced chemicals on the afferent arterioles, and so there are other chemicals that affect vasoconstriction or vasodilation, and we call this the tubuloglomerular feedback. So one is just a direct response of the smooth muscles due to pressure, and the other is the response of those same smooth muscles to signaling molecules, and that's what we call tubuloglomerular feedback. Okay, so here's a pretty good table that shows, that just tabulates the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic mechanisms. So here is some regulation by sympathetic nerves that are going to the kidney. All right, so there are sympathetic nerves that go into the kidney. And so is this intrinsic or extrinsic mechanism? It's extrinsic because it's coming from outside the kidney, and it's activated by the baroreceptor reflex or maybe even higher brain centers. And increase in sympathetic tone causes a constriction of the afferent arteriole, and that's going to decrease filtration rate, and that's going to decrease urine formation. All right, so that's important. What kind of response is your body going through when you have a lot of sympathetic outflow? Is it fight or flight or rest and repose? Fight or flight. So what should happen to your blood pressure when you're in that fight or flight mode? Should it be decreasing or should it be increasing? Should be increasing, right? So decreasing glomerular filtration is a way to maintain your blood pressure under those stressful circumstances. All right, so that is extrinsic because it's a result of the sympathetic nervous system. And then we have two autoregulation mechanisms right here. So a decrease in blood pressure, what's going to happen to the afferent arteriole when there's a decrease in blood pressure, but we want to maintain glomerular filtration at the same rate, so we don't want any change. So as blood pressure decreases, what does the afferent arteriole have to do to maintain flow the same? It's got to dilate, right? All right, so that could be due to the myogenic response or the tubuloglomerular response. So both of those are intrinsic, just properties of the glomerulus. And if blood pressure goes the other way, then the smooth muscles of the afferent arteriole are going to constrict to maintain filtration rate at the same level, okay? So that you have control over urine formation. Okay. Okay, so in terms of the tubular glomerular feedback, an increase in flow of filtrate through the distal convoluted tubule is sensed by the macula densa cells of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, and it signals, All right, that thick segment of the ascending loop of Henle. Okay, and this signals the afferent arterioles to constrict. Okay, so you might have to go back. I think I showed you a picture of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Okay, well, reabsorption of salt and water. Remember, filtration, I think about 20% of the plasma gets filtered out by tubular filtration. And you would dehydrate in just a matter of seconds if you lost that fluid. All right, so you actually have to resorb most of the water back into your circulatory system. Otherwise, you'd turn into a potato chip. And that happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. The PCT returns most molecules and water from the filtrate back into the peritubular capillaries. Can you picture where those peritubular capillaries are? All right. About 180 liters per day of ultrafiltrate are produced. And I just call it filtrate. Your book calls it ultrafiltrate. That comes from the glomerulus. All right. And that's about what? That's about, I think, 45 gallons. All right. That's something that's kind of interesting. Maybe you should just put in the back of your mind. All right. But only 1 to 2 liters of urine are excreted in 24 hours. All right. So 180 are filtered, but only 1 to 2 are actually secreted. So what happens to the difference right here? Which is what? Most of it. Right? 178 liters gets resorbed. And what's that process? We call that tubular resorption. And that happens in different parts of the nephron. All right, so urine production varies according to needs of the body. And a minimum amount of urine has to be produced to get rid of organic molecules, waste products that our bodies are producing. And that minimum amount is almost half a liter a day, but 400 mLs per day. So that's what's necessary to excrete metabolic wastes. And we call that the obligatory water loss. So you need at least that much intake a day, all right, to keep your kidneys healthy if you want to have the same water balance. Okay, so the transport of molecules out of the tubular filtrate and back into the blood, right, so here are solutes going back into the blood, is what we call resorption or reabsorption. And water is never transported out. All right, then I think you should find that pretty strange. And the way that works is that other molecules, the solutes, are transported out. And as the osmolality of the interstitial fluid increases, guess what happens to water? It just moves down its concentration gradient. All right, so what do you call it when water moves through a selectively permeable membrane down its concentration gradient? Okay, that is osmosis, right? That's just passive transport. So water is passively transported in the kidney, but it's the solutes that might need help, that might need active transport. All right, so this is a pretty good slide because we see the first two processes that produce urine. The first one is filtration, and the second process is reabsorption. All right. The proximal convoluted tubule is set up to resorb maybe 100% of nutrients like glucose and potassium, and it can't be regulated. It can't be adjusted. The proximal convoluted tubule is working at 100% of its capacity all of the time and can't adjust any solute concentration in the filtrate. And so that's the job of the other parts of the tubular elements of the nephron, okay, to make adjustments, fine adjustments in urine formation. All right, so let's look at the mechanism of resorption of, in particular, sodium and glucose in the proximal tubule. All right, so here is the lumen of the kidney tubule, like the proximal convoluted tubule. So this, what's contained in this area here? And I think you're familiar with this slide already. It should be a blast to the past. I think this was even an exam figure before. All right, so this is the lumen. This is what contains filtrate. This is the material that's been filtered out of the glomerulus. All right, and that includes important metabolites such as glucose. And if glucose stayed in the filtrate, where is it going to end up? In the urine, right? And so that would be a big waste of energy. And I think I mentioned that before. That would be like going to the gas station, filling up your gas tank, and then putting a hole in your gas tank, letting the gasoline just dribble out. All right, so you don't want to lose glucose. All right, and you don't want to lose sodium. All right, so these are transported into the cell of the proximal tubule, And this is because sodium is at a high concentration in the filtrate. Glucose is at a low concentration compared to the cell. So how do we get glucose going from low concentration to high concentration across the apical membrane? Is that going to just happen passively? As a matter of fact, no, it has to happen actively. There's got to be an energy source. But you see in the ATP right here. So it can't be primary active transport. You see that it is being transported along with sodium. So what is the energy source for making glucose go from low concentration to high concentration inside the cell? So probably you should not forget that a concentration gradient is an energy source that your body uses, and the concentration gradient that's being used as the energy source is the concentration gradient of sodium. It's high outside the cell, and probably if you ever take a test, you just automatically want to say that, right? Sodium is, in a healthy cell, high outside and low inside. What ion should be high inside the cell? Potassium, yeah, okay. All right, so sodium, the gradient of sodium from high outside to low inside is the energy source for making glucose move from low concentration to high. So that, what kind of transport do we call that? We see co-transport, but maybe even a better way of thinking of that, since ATP isn't directly involved, that is what? Secondary active transport. So glucose is imported due to secondary active transport, so now it's high inside the cell, and then it will move down its concentration gradient into the plasma right here, going from high concentration to low in the plasma. But what can you tell me about glucose? Can it just do that? No, can't get through the plasma membrane. It needs a channel or transporter to move, and that's what we call facilitated diffusion. It's moving passively, but it still needs a transporter. All right, now how do we deal with all that sodium inside the cell? We want that sodium in this blood vessel right here. Well, here is just the old reliable sodium-potassium ATP pump that is pumping sodium from high concentration from inside the cell to even lower outside right over here, and then that sodium is moved into the blood vessel, all right, along with glucose. So this happens where? In the proximal tubule. So glucose reabsorption needs this secondary active transporter. So it's moved by active transport. Okay, so sodium is actively transported out. Chlorine goes along with sodium to maintain electrical neutrality. And then water follows. Salt, that's basically due to osmosis, right? Water moving from high concentration in the tubule to outside. And at this point, the fluid is reduced to one-third of its original volume, but it's still isoosmotic, right? It's still the same concentration of salt compared to the rest of your body. Okay. So what's the significance of resorption in the proximal convoluted tubule? About 65% of the sodium chloride in water is reabsorbed, right, and returned to the bloodstream. And an additional 20% is reabsorbed in the descending loop of Henle. So what's that? That's about 85% that gets resorbed. So it seems like a big waste of time and energy to, what, filter all of that water and then have to resorb it. But you know what? That's an excellent way of getting rid of solutes that are dissolved in your plasma that really have no other way of being excreted from your body. For instance, like urea and other kinds of toxic compounds. So everything is thrown out and then water is resorbed. All right, so this is constant and independent of hydration level. So the PCT is just working at 100% of its ability all the time, can't be adjusted. And here is something pretty fascinating. The energy cost is 6% of your total daily calories to run those ATP pumps, just to resorb water and salt. So those kidneys are highly metabolic, right? And anything that disrupts that metabolism, the production of ATP is going to kill the kidneys, right? For instance, like what? Diabetes mellitus, for instance, because those kidneys are so highly metabolic. All right, the remaining 15% is resorbed variably of the water that we're talking about, depending on the level of hydration. So if you're overhydrated, then you're going to lose that 15% of water. If you're dehydrated, that water will be reabsorbed by the distal segments of the kidney tubules. And that's where we're going to look at a couple of hormones that adjust that. Okay. And so here is a distal tubule, a collecting duct. Plays an important role in water conservation, meaning what? Resorption of water, so we don't lose water in urine. It is impermeable to salt in the medulla. It's permeable to, its permeability, all right, sometimes is zero and sometimes it's high, but it's dependent on levels of antidiuretic hormone. So antidiuretic hormone can adjust water reabsorption in collecting ducts. Okay, I think I need to talk about some of these slides first. So how does that happen? Let's look at the homeostasis of plasma concentration maintained by ADH. All right, so basically what does ADH do? What's the name? Anti-diuretic hormone. It makes you retain water, right? So don't lose sight of that picture, okay? All right, so where does ADH come from? What organ secretes anti-diuretic hormone? It's your pituitary. Yeah, and the pituitary is sort of complicated. It's got a couple parts. What part? It's the posterior pituitary, right? So it doesn't need releasing hormones. It uses a tract, right? Just an axonal tract right through the infundibulum down into the posterior pituitary from the hypothalamus. So let's start by looking at this mechanism right here. What happens if there's low water intake, which produces dehydration? All right, so what happens to the saltiness of plasma when you're dehydrated? It goes up, right? And that's the same thing as increasing plasma osmolality. It just means that it gets saltier. And there's a part of your body that can monitor osmolality of blood, and that is there are central receptors. That's in the hypothalamus, okay? And when the so that's the integration center. And if it's and if it realizes your blood osmolality is increasing, it makes a decision to what? To retain water, get as much water as possible from urine, right? To maintain homeostasis. So the hypothalamus then sends signals down into the posterior pituitary to increase the secretion of ADH, and ADH goes to the kidneys. Right, and at the kidneys, it increases water reabsorption. So you lose less water in the urine. Okay, and how does this response compare to this initial stimulus? They subtract from each other, so here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, and if on the other hand you're overhydrated, your plasma osmolality decreases, and again the integration center in the hypothalamus realizes that, and it sends signals to the posterior pituitary to decrease the amount of ADH that's being released. As ADH concentration decreases, the kidneys then decrease water reabsorption, and then more water is produced in the urine. Okay, and again, that subtracts from the initial stimulus, producing homeostasis. Okay, so ADH, increasing ADH can produce very small amounts of concentrated urine. As ADH is decreasing, that's going to produce copious amounts of watery urine, less concentrated urine, right? So you should probably have a feeling for that. Okay, and this involves what? The collecting ducts. What ADH does is that it stimulates the insertion of water channels, right? So the collecting ducts by themselves are impermeable to water, and there have to be water channels inserted into the plasma membrane so that water can be reabsorbed. So that's the job of ADH, and this is in the collecting duct. All right, so when ADH is high, water is drawn out of the collecting duct by high osmolality of interstitial fluid, and it's resorbed by the peritubular capillaries in this more medullary part of the collecting duct. So what's another name for vasorecta? Where do you find the vasorecta? It's a kind of capillary. All right, it's a peritubular capillary that we find in the juxtamedullary nephron, right? And the juxtamedullary nephron is the kind of nephron that's specialized to make concentrated urine, for instance, when there is a large ADH signal, is going to produce small amounts of very concentrated urine. All right, the cortical nephrons don't really do a good job of that. You need the juxtamedullary nephron. All right, so here is a figure that's not in your textbook, okay? But it is an exam figure. So I put it in your study guide for the chapter. All right, and I also put the key to this figure in the study guide. So you got two of these figures. One is colored that has all the answers, and then one is in black and white like you would see on the test that you have to label. All right, and hopefully you'll appreciate why I put this in your student study guide, and then too bad it's not in your textbook. Well, what do we got right here? Well, we've got a kidney tubule, in particular the collecting duct, right? So this is like the distal parts of the nephron. So here is the filtrate that's moving through a kidney tubule. And then here is the wall of the tubule made up of these nice, what kind of cells do these look like? What kind of epithelium does this look like? Just a nice simple cuboidal epithelium, right? Right, because there's machinery involved with this. It's just not a squamous epithelium. All right, and then here is an interstitial space that has fluid in it, and then here is the vasa recta. Here is the capillary. Right, and of course you have just a simple epithelium here for supporting exchange. All right, so these are the structures we're looking at: filtrate, wall of the tubule, interstitial fluid, and then plasma, blood. And what are we interested in looking at? We're interested in looking at antidiuretic hormone, and here it is in the blood. That's a signaling molecule. What's another name for antidiuretic hormone? People use these interchangeably all the time. Vasopressin, right? So I didn't modify the slide. So vasopressin and antidiuretic hormone are the exact same compound. And vasopressin is a protein. And can proteins go across a cell membrane? Why or why not? We looked at a number of different hormones. What kind of hormones can cross the plasma membrane of a cell? Yeah, it's got to be a lipid, right? It's got to be a hydrophobic kind of molecule. And a good kind of lipid hormone would be, for instance, a steroid, right? And ADH is not a steroid, it's a protein. So ADH can't get inside the cell. So where is the receptor for ADH on this tubular cell? It's got to be on the surface of the cell, on the plasma membrane. So indeed, ADH binds to the surface receptor. All right, but then how does that make us change the metabolism inside the cell? How does it change the physiology inside the cell? Since vasopressin can't get in, or ADH can't get in, it works through a second messenger system. Okay, and what's your favorite second messenger? Oh yeah, cyclic AMP would be fine. I wouldn't get my feelings hurt if you were to say that. If you were to snub calcium, for instance, or some other kind of second messenger. But, all right, on the tip of your tongue should be cyclic AMP. All right, so the vasopressin receptor converts ATP into cyclic AMP, and that institutes a cascade of events inside the cell, which act on these vesicles right here that have the aquapore and water pores in them. So what do we call these vesicles that hold a membrane component, right? It has sequestered them out of the membrane, but is holding them in reserve until it gets a proper signal to put them back in the membrane. That's what we call an endosome, right? So cyclic AMP then activates these endosomes. They are inserted into the plasma membrane. So now you have water channels in the cell, and water can be reabsorbed as a result of that. And you're familiar with this scheme before, because how was it used before? Where have you seen an endosome before? Yeah, for instance, in the GLUT4 transporters. And insulin is a proteinaceous hormone that binds to a receptor, a cell surface receptor, but it doesn't work through cyclic AMP, second messenger system. What can you tell me about insulin receptor? It's a tyrosine kinase, so it phosphorylates various tyrosine amino acids on regulatory proteins, right, which then insert the GLUT4 transporters into the membrane. So that's just a common theme that we've seen before. All right, so why does water move into the cell? Well, look at the solute concentration. All right, it is higher inside the cell than in the filtrate. So water is going to, what do we call that? Going through a selectively permeable membrane. Osmosis. And how does it end up in the blood? Because in the vasa recta, the osmolality of blood is very high. It's 700 milliosmolar. So water is going to reabsorb, but it can only be reabsorbed when these aquaporins are put in the membrane. And they're put in the membrane as a result of this ADH signal. Okay? Okay, so I think a lot of, so I think this slide is really cool because you've seen, you're familiar with all of these little processes before and you learned them bit by bit, but you never really realized why you were learning all those little pieces. All right, so here is another reason why you learned all those little pieces. Okay, all right, so that's important. Okay, so we can go back to that if we got time later if you got a question. All right, so secretion is the opposite of reabsorption, all right? Active transport of substances from the peritubular capillaries into the tubular fluid is what we call secretion. So here we have a little bit of a nephron right here. The first process is what we call filtration, right? The second process, when solutes and even water move from filtrate into the blood, is what we call tubular reabsorption. And if there are compounds that your body wants to get rid of, like excess potassium, excess hydrogen ion, and other metabolites that are toxic like urea, they can be moved from the blood into the filtrate by a process we call secretion. Okay, and then urine formation, right, after urine is formed, it's excreted from your body. So you should have an appreciation of an expression for excretion. What is excretion? How much material is going to be excreted? It's going to be due to the amount of material that's filtered, all right, plus the amount that is secreted, minus the amount that is reabsorbed. And so that is what's going to equal excretion. Okay, so excretion rate is what? Filtration rate plus secretion. That means it's putting material into the blood minus the amount of material that is resorbed. So that is excretion. Okay, or what we call renal clearance. Okay, so not all the blood delivered to the glomerulus is filtered into the glomerular capsule. 20% is filtered. The remainder passes into the efferent arteriole and then back into the circulations. Substances that aren't filtered can still be cleared by active transport, right, by secretion. So things that aren't filtered still can be put into the tubular filtrate by secretion. Right, and we just looked at, we looked at reabsorption in terms of ADH. All right, so filtered glucose and amino acids are normally 100% reabsorbed from the filtrate. We don't want to lose any glucose. Right, and this occurs in the proximal tubule by carrier-mediated transport with sodium. We looked at a nice diagram of that. All right, but that transporter displays saturation if the ligand concentration is too high. Right, so if the transporters are overwhelmed with glucose, not all the glucose can be reabsorbed. All right, and then, so what happens to that glucose if the glucose concentration is so high that it can't be resorbed? Where does that glucose end up? In the urine as a result of that. Okay, so the level needed to saturate the carriers and achieve maximum transport is what we call the transport maximum, and that's just due to the number of transporters that are placed in the membrane. And glucose and amino acid transporters don't saturate under normal conditions. So what condition would saturate somebody's glucose transporters? Like diabetes mellitus, when your blood glucose is not being regulated by insulin for whatever reason and your blood glucose goes sky high, that saturates all the transporters, then that residual glucose, that high glucose is in the urine and you actually excrete it. Okay. So in the presence of glucose in the urine, this occurs when glucose gets over 180 or 200 milligrams per ml plasma. We call that the renal threshold. And glucose will be lost in the urine when the plasma concentration exceeds what the renal plasma threshold for reabsorption. And then that glucose is going to be lost in the urine. Okay, glucose is not normally in urine because plasma levels stay below that value when it's under control. All right, hyperglycemia has to exceed the renal plasma threshold. Right, diabetes mellitus occurs when hyperglycemia results in glycosuria. So glycosuria is just glucose in the urine, and somebody with uncontrolled diabetes can have so much glucose in urine that you can actually see sugar crystals in the urine when somebody voids. Right, and that's really unfortunate because that person is really, really sick when that happens. Okay. All right, so let's talk about renal control of electrolyte. We're not going to talk about acid-base balance, but we're going to talk about electrolyte. So we looked at how water reabsorption, what hormone controls water reabsorption in the distal segments of the nephron? ADH, right, antidiuretic hormone, can make some final adjustments to water reabsorption in the distal tubules of the nephron. Okay, but what about electrolytes? There's a different hormone that's involved with regulation of electrolyte levels. Okay, it's not antidiuretic hormone. All right, so the kidneys can regulate levels of sodium and potassium and hydrogen ion and bicarbonate, chloride, and even phosphate by matching excretion to the amount that's in intake in your diet. All right, control of plasma sodium is important in regulation of blood volume and hence, what else? Blood pressure, right? So that's very important. Potassium is very important for proper function of cardiac and skeletal muscles and even nerves. Why is potassium important? What happens when potassium levels increase in the extracellular fluid? What can you tell me? What's something really bad that happens? The membrane, the resting membrane potential changes. In which way does the resting membrane potential move when somebody has more potassium in their outside the cells? Remember, potassium should be high inside the cell, not outside. And when it's high outside the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It hyperpolarizes, which means what? You need a bigger stimulus to reach threshold before an action potential can take place. Right? So you could almost think of poisoning the cell because it never reaches threshold when potassium levels increase. Okay. So 90% of the filtered sodium and potassium is resorbed before the distal tubular segments of the nephron. All right? And as a matter of fact, I would say even 100% of the potassium is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. But the remainder of the sodium and even potassium can be resorbed in distal tubular segments and the cortical collecting duct according to the body's needs. All right, so potassium resorption or secretion can take place in the collecting ducts as a result or as regulated by aldosterone. So that's the signaling molecule. So ADH is for adjusting water. Aldosterone is for adjusting these electrolyte levels in the nephron. All right, so aldosterone controls potassium secretion and sodium reabsorption. So which direction are potassium and sodium going as a result of aldosterone signaling molecule? Same direction or opposite directions? Opposite directions, right? So if you ever see a question on a board exam or something and you see that potassium is going one way and sodium is going the other, automatically without thinking, you should say, well, that's the result of aldosterone right here, all right? But you're going to have a little bit better understanding of that in just a little bit. Okay, but that's just to help you through maybe a time when you're under a lot of pressure and you got to make a decision really quick about a question. Okay, so in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed in the distal tubule and cortical collecting duct. All right, so you're still going to lose a little bit, but when aldosterone is high, all of the remaining sodium is resorbed. All right, so aldosterone can make some fine-tuning of how much sodium is lost in the urine. When aldosterone is high, all the sodium is resorbed. You won't lose any sodium in the nephron. Okay? All right, potassium, on the other hand, almost all of it is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, but when there is aldosterone stimulation, potassium is secreted back into the cortical portions of the nephron. All right, so all potassium in urine is from secretion rather than filtration. So think all of it is resorbed, and then if there's excess potassium in your body, it is secreted in these distal segments of the nephron. Under what kind of conditions? When there is an aldosterone signal. And you probably know where that aldosterone comes from, but we'll review it in just a little bit. Okay. So, it comes from what? The renin-angiotensin aldosterone mechanism, and what stimulates that? Well, it is the juxtaglomerular apparatus in the kidney. So here is a nephron, here's Bowman's capsule, here's the PCT, loop of Henle, And here is the distal convoluted tubule. And when it comes back up into the cortex, it passes right in between the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole. And this is where the juxtaglomerular apparatus is. So let's zoom into this region right here. So here is what? The distal convoluted tubule. And here is a special segment of that tubule that's called the macula densa. And it's very close to some cells right here. Sometimes we call these the juxtaglomerular cells or the JG cells. And even sometimes we call these granular cells because they can release things that control constriction of the afferent arteriole and other kinds of things. Okay? So the juxtaglomerular apparatus is a specialized region in each nephron. So every nephron has one of these things where the afferent arteriole comes in contact with the ascending loop of Henle or this distal tubule right here. So it's got these specialized cells. All right, and so the JG is activated. It releases renin from the granular cells. Can you remember where? So here, these are the cells that release renin. Okay, within the afferent arteriole. And then renin converts angiotensinogen, you should know that's an inactive compound, into angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 is converted into angiotensin 2 by the angiotensin converting enzyme in the lungs. And then angiotensin 2 stimulates release of aldosterone. And what organ releases aldosterone? That would be the posterior pituitary releases antidiuretic hormone, but aldosterone comes from the adrenal cortex. Adrenal cortex. Okay? We've talked about this before. All right, so let's look at what stimulates renin secretion. Inadequate intake of salt always causes decreased blood volume, right? Because lower osmolality inhibits ADH. Right, so ADH is not going to be secreted when salt is low, dietary salt is low. All right, so when ADH goes away, you're going to be producing a lot of urine, causing less water reabsorption. And that produces a low blood volume and low renal blood flow. Stimulate renin release from the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, so via direct effects of blood pressure on the granular cells and by sympathetic activity initiated by the baroreceptor reflex. Okay, so here is a flow chart of how that works. So we're going to be talking about aldosterone. This slide shows an interaction between antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone. So when there is a low sodium intake, we have low plasma sodium concentration. Does that make sense? When you don't eat a lot of salt, you're going to have low sodium concentration. And that produces what? A low osmolality in blood. What monitors osmolality in blood? The hypothalamus. Right? So the hypothalamus sees low osmolality. And that signals the posterior pituitary to stop secreting antidiuretic hormone. So then you lose water as a result of that. So antidiuretic hormone decreases. That decreases water reabsorption in the collecting ducts. All right, so the aquaporins are going to be put in to endosomes. Instead of in the plasma membrane, they're going to be put into endosomes. So water reabsorption in the collecting duct decreases. So that means water is not resorbed and watery urine is produced. All right, and as we lose water, what happens to blood volume? It goes down. Okay, and as blood volume goes down, what else goes down? When blood volume goes down, blood pressure goes down. So what monitors blood pressure? The baroreceptor reflex. All right, so baroreceptor reflex says blood volume is going down, so it's going to increase sympathetic nerve activity as a result. Okay. This decreased blood volume now is also going to stimulate the kidney, namely the juxtaglomerular apparatus, and sympathetic nerves stimulate the juxtaglomerular apparatus to release renin. And what is renin? Is it a hormone or what? What is renin? What does renin do? Renin is an enzyme. Okay, so renin is an enzyme What does it do? It can convert angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. So we're missing a couple steps right here. Right, and angiotensin 1 gets converted into angiotensin 2 by, what, ACE in the lungs. Angiotensin 2 goes to the adrenal cortex and causes the release of aldosterone. And what does aldosterone do? Opposite effects on sodium and potassium, but it causes sodium reabsorption and potassium secretion, right? Opposite effects. And as sodium resorption increases, right, then sodium is retained in the blood, and that's a nice negative feedback mechanism because this response subtracts from the initial stimulus right here. All right, so that brings sodium concentration back to its normal level. All right, so that this mechanism here requires both antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone to work properly to maintain sodium homeostasis. All right, so here is the second and last figure that I put in your study guide that's not in your book that shows how aldosterone works in the body. Okay, got a couple minutes left. All right, so what organ are we looking at right here? And what part of the organ? We're looking at the kidney, and in particular, a nephron. All right, so again, here is filtrate in the lumen of a distal tubule of the nephron. Here is the wall of that tubule, and what can you tell me about this wall? It's made out of just a simple cuboidal epithelium. All right, so then here is the interstitial space or interstitial fluid that is surrounding the peritubular capillary. So here is blood. All right, and the signaling molecule that's going to adjust electrolytes, right, is not vasopressin or antidiuretic hormone, it is aldosterone. Okay. All right, so what can you tell me about aldosterone? What kind of molecule is it? What's the physical chemistry of aldosterone? It's a steroid, so it's a lipid, right? So what can lipids do with a plasma membrane? Are they blocked by a plasma membrane? Nope, they can move right through, right? So aldosterone leaves the blood through this. But since this is a capillary, just a simple squamous endothelium, moves into the interstitial space, right through the plasma membrane, because it's a lipid. And so here is the receptor, right? So don't forget, steroid hormones can have cytoplasmic receptors because they go right through the plasma membrane, binds to the receptor, and this receptor hormone complex acts as a transcription factor. Oh, what does transcription mean? What's it? It's an important first step of what? Protein synthesis, right? So what's the first step in protein synthesis? It is transcription. And what does transcription mean? Taking information in DNA and converting it into information in RNA. That's transcription. All right, so this receptor hormone complex initiates transcription, means that it makes messenger RNA in the nucleus. The messenger RNA moves into the cytoplasm for the second step of protein synthesis, which is translation. Okay, so various proteins are made as a result of this signaling molecule, aldosterone. So what kind of proteins are made? Well, it makes new channels, right? So it makes new protein channels for potassium and sodium. So it makes new potassium and sodium channels. It can make new regulatory molecules that can regulate when these channels are open, and in particular will increase the opening of these channels. And it can also make new primary active transport pumps. And so, for instance, here is the typical kind of sodium potassium pump that you're familiar with. And what can you tell me about sodium and potassium for the sodium potassium ATP pump? Which way does sodium and potassium move? Do they move in the same direction or opposite directions? Opposite. And which way does potassium get pumped? Potassium gets pumped into the cell and sodium gets pumped out of the cell. All right, so that's what we learned like in the second chapter, something like that, right? So sodium is going to be high outside the cell. Potassium is going to be high inside because of this sodium-potassium ATP pump. But furthermore, what you should realize is what? Sodium and potassium move in opposite directions, and that's basically how we can explain the action of aldosterone, in that potassium and sodium have to move in opposite directions because of that basic sodium-potassium pump right here. Okay? All right, so aldosterone acts as a transcription factor to make more sodium-potassium pumps, more channels for potassium and sodium in the apical membrane over here. So let's see what happens. All right, so when there is an aldosterone signal, okay, more protein synthesis, making more channels for potassium, more channels for sodium. So sodium is going to move down its concentration gradient, so high in the filtrate to lower inside the cell, and it's low inside the cell because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. All right, and then sodium becomes high in the interstitial fluid, and then it just moves by diffusion into the blood as a result of that. And what about potassium? Since it's being pumped into the cell, this is low concentration compared to high concentration in the blood. Potassium moves out, moves into the cell, and then the concentration of potassium in the filtrate is basically zero because it was already resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, almost 100% of it. So potassium leaves the cell, but there's got to be what? There's got to be a channel there. Neither sodium nor potassium can move across any membrane without a channel. Okay, so that's what aldosterone does. So we learned about all these little pieces during the course, but now you see it all put together for controlling potassium secretion and sodium resorption in the distal parts of the nephron tubule. Okay, so if these proteins aren't being made, then neither potassium or sodium is going to move across the membrane right here. Okay, can't be adjusted. But aldosterone can adjust the levels of potassium and sodium in the filtrate as a result of putting these and regulating these channels and by putting more sodium-potassium pumps in the basolateral membrane. Okay, so you have this in your study guide, and then you have the mock test one, the one with all the answers erased from it. Okay? Okay. The macula densa is located where we talked about, okay, right at the entrance to the glomerulus, and it acts as a sensor for tubular glomerular feedback needed for autoregulation of glomerular filtrations. The macula densa can signal the afferent arteriole to constrict, okay, and signals the granular cells to decrease secretion of renin when blood sodium is high. All right, so this is an important little place in every nephron. Let me see what the next slide is. Oh, okay, we're almost done. Let me see if I need to say anything else about this particular slide. Okay, let's look at the effects of renin secretion. Okay, renin secretion by these granular cells of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So blood volume is decreased. That increases secretion of renin. Right, that increases angiotensin II, that increases aldosterone, right, and so that's going to increase blood volume as a result. When blood volume is increased, that the granular cells decrease release of renin, that decreases angiotensin II, that decreases aldosterone, and that's going to decrease blood volume. When potassium is high, all right, what's happening to aldosterone when potassium is high? Okay, let's look to this slide right here. Which way is potassium moving? It's being secreted when aldosterone is present. All right, so aldosterone increases secretion into the filtrate of potassium, so it helps potassium secretion. So that subtracts from the initial stimulus right here. Right, so aldosterone increases secretion, brings potassium plasma concentrations back to normal. And increased sympathetic nerve activity increases aldosterone, right, and that helps maintain blood pressure. Okay, because the beta adrenergic, and I guess I'm not going to ask you about alpha or beta adrenergic effects on the juxtaglomerular apparatus, but you should just realize that sympathetic innervation causes an increase in aldosterone, which causes sodium resorption, which causes an increase in water resorption as well. Okay. Then the last hormone, and I think we've talked about this already, so we've seen that ADH and aldosterone both increase blood pressure by increasing blood volume. So in order to have fine control of that system, it's nice to have an antagonistic hormone that works in opposition to those two, and that is atrial natriuretic hormone, or peptide. And that's produced by, where is atrial natriuretic hormone released from? In the atria, right? That's just in the name of that hormone. All right, so it's produced by the atria due to stretching of the walls of the atria. So when do the walls of the atria stretch? When is the atrium the smallest? During contraction, during systole, and it stretches during diastole when it's filling with blood, right? Okay, and as blood volume increases, you have increased venous return, so that means that the atria stretch more when blood volume increases. And as they stretch, there are stretch receptors that release atrial natriuretic hormone. And so these go to the kidney and stimulate salt and water excretion. So these are antagonistic to both ADH and aldosterone, right? And it acts like an endogenous diuretic, right? So your body uses ADH and aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone to adjust blood pressure and via blood volume all the time. But these are what? Long-term mechanisms. Okay, so they're not as important as, say, for instance, the baroreceptor reflex, like when you stand up quickly, okay, and run out of the room. Okay, that would be the baroreceptor reflex. Okay. All right, so that's it for the test. All right, but this is an important figure, and that other handout is a very important figure. So, you know what? If you can't get into Blackboard and you don't know how to access the handouts for the test, then you have to see me and get a photocopy of these things. Okay, so it's not mandatory that you have internet access in this class, so if you need to get these materials, then you have to see me during office hours sometime. Yeah. Oh, everything is still up, but I just want to make sure, because all of the other figures that I've shown in the class, you had a copy of in your book. But these two here specifically, you do not have in your book. So I just want to be absolutely clear that, you know, you can't use your book as a resource for these two other figures. And if you've not been going to Blackboard to get those auxiliary sources for studying, you got to see me before the test to get these figures to practice on. Okay? Okay. So if you're good with Blackboard, you don't have to see me. Some other students had some questions about in the urinary system. I didn't have any materials from the 10th edition of Fox. You know, they have multiple choice and fill in the blank and true and false questions. We're using the 11th edition, so this is the previous edition. I didn't have time to go back and look at any of those questions. There's probably great questions in there, but I just didn't have time to look. So if you want to go to the 10th edition and look at the materials for chapter 17, that's great if you want to do that. I just don't specifically can't recommend any questions in particular. Okay? Yeah, I think I said that to some that effect anyway.
To the philosophy of alternative medicine.